You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A glittering 500-seat Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise in Beijing, inexpensive DVD players in Omaha, a city that manufactures only buttons, and a global economy saved from the brink of collapse. Welcome to Chimerica, the behemoth that has been formed from the unintentional merger of the world's two largest national economies. Zachary Carabel was on the show in November to discuss his book, Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. Listeners told us that they enjoyed the segment, and we thought we would play it for you again as people are laying gifts made in Chimerica under their Christmas trees. Mr. Carabel, who is an economist, visited our show before to talk about his book, Peace Be Upon You, which detailed the history of coexistence between Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And he's also written several books on American history. So I began by asking him, why have you waited until now to write a book on an economic topic, considering your financial background?
Well, I mean, part of it was while I was immersed in actually doing the daily business of running an investment fund that focused on Chinese and U.S. companies, I probably lacked the perspective to write the book. And interestingly enough, even though there is no logical connection between writing a book on Muslims, Christians, and Jews and coexistence or the potential of it and a book on the economic fusion between China and the United States, in some sense, these are the two main issues facing both the world and the United States for this decade.
And actually, some of it comes up in relations with China, between the United States and China. On the first page of your book, you take us back to January 2009 when the U.S. government authorized more than $1 trillion in spending and tax cut stimulus bills. What's the Chinese connection with that?
The Chinese connection is that in order to float that extra spending, the United States government had to take on extra debt. And in order to take on extra debt, they had to auction treasury notes. And the main foreign buyer of those treasuries was China.
Is that because China is the only country in fact, out there that has a thriving economy?
It is certainly the only country that has had a thriving economy in the past year, and the only one that is so tethered to the U.S. economy that whether or not it feels particularly comfortable about what's going on in the United States economically, it has no choice but to reinvest in the U.S. economy with the dollars that it keeps accumulating because of the economic relationship.
And the United States, which has all sorts of concerns about certain Chinese things, has no other options either.
Right. And
this is a marriage that has to survive despite all the problems.
Right. And this is the big question, I think, that people are asking today. I think many people realize that there's been this particularly intimate economic relationship that's emerged over the past years. And now people are wondering, is it an end? Is there going to be a divorce? A lot of people I know get concerned because Chinese officials have frequently said they would rather have a different currency than the dollar. They would rather not be as dependent on the U.S. economy. Well, I'd rather have a large yacht off of St. Bart's, but neither of these things are going to happen anytime soon.
We're their biggest market.
We are their biggest market. And the one thing I think America is not as attuned to is that China is the most vibrant market for American companies operating in China.
Backing up, were the loans that were bought by the Chinese bought by the government or by private Chinese financial institutions?
Almost entirely by the government, almost entirely by the central bank. There's a real limit on how much Chinese financial institutions are permitted to invest outside of China.
How did the economic meltdown of last September and the American credit crisis affect China specifically?
Well, one, it certainly alarmed Chinese leaders because they had assumed, largely since Tiananmen Square, so for the past 20 years, China has said, look, we're going to engage in hypercharged economic reform. And if you're going to do that, you have to deal with the United States as, until now, the largest, most important market and economy in the world. So they just thought the American system was going to lead the world. And when the crisis hit last year, it certainly shook the Chinese conviction about the stability of the U.S. system.
And you say, you mentioned Tiananmen Square. For many people, Tiananmen Square was the end. You suggest that it actually was the beginning?
Because it was the end of political reform, but it was the real beginning of hypercharged economic reform. And that's a choice that was made by the Chinese leadership, that we will foreclose political reform, but we will invigorate economic reform. And that really is what has guided the Chinese leadership for the past 20 years.
And it's their way to get around the fact that we were so disturbed by what happened at Tiananmen Square?
I think it was the way to recognize that human beings have a certain suite of needs, and that if you can satisfy some of them, you probably don't need to satisfy all of them. And people like economic security. They like a feeling of autonomy and independence. They like the feeling that they are masters of some of their own destiny. And in China over the past 20 years, the government has allowed a level of individual freedom as well as material well-being that has satisfied a lot of those needs, even while saying, look, you cannot have any political participation.
The Bank of China had been the largest foreign purchaser of mortgage-backed bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yeah, I mean, this is...
That has to have caused a mini crisis in China.
Yeah, and I think actually the Chinese holdings in those very large pseudo-American government entities, they weren't, but they were, in the summer of 2008, helped precipitate the whole crisis as it unfolded, because the Chinese owned several hundred million dollars of these bonds and just assumed that either the value would go up or the American government would bail out those holdings. And when that looked like it wouldn't happen, the U.S. government basically had to step in and prevent China from losing its money, because China was basically saying, if you don't do this, we may have to reconsider our loans.
But wouldn't that also have tipped the scales of power away from the United States and towards China?
I think the scales of power are more structural. They're not really about momentary decisions. So it would have created some disruptions. But I think what's going on is a much sort of longer trend of China emerging, the United States being the dominant power, and the balance shifting. And how much it shifts is what we're still unknown.
20 years ago or so, I can't remember just how long ago, there was a lot of stuff in the newspapers about how the Japanese were buying up the United States and how they owned so much of the U.S. national debt and how that was a major concern. We haven't been reading that sort of thing in regards to China. Why do you think that is?
Well, one, I think it's actually not a good analogy. It's not a good historical comparison, although it does come up, and people do want to know, okay, why is China going to be different than Japan? And part of it is that it's not just that China lends the U.S. money or that there's an economic ascendancy. It's actually that China's system owes an immense amount to the actions and investments of U.S. companies and individuals doing business in China. You really can't understand the Chinese economic miracle without understanding the Kentucky Fried Chickens and the Avons and the thousands of entrepreneurs, American entrepreneurs, who've invested literally $1 trillion over the past 20 years in China. That never happened with Japan.
The Japanese resisted American businesses coming there, and the Chinese have welcomed them?
Which is ironic, given that, in theory at least, the Chinese are a closed economic system and Japan was a liberal democracy. But indeed, Japan never allowed for foreign ownership. It was almost impossible for a foreign entity to do business in Japan. And China has made it increasingly easy.
Does the Chinese media write about this?
The Chinese media covers business. They cover American business deals. They cover Chinese. I mean, whether they write about the intricacies of that kind of depends on the attitudes of the moment, because a lot of these companies in China still are quasi-state-owned. And like anything else, people need to be careful about what they say about government-owned or government-backed entities. So I wouldn't say there's incredibly strong candor, but there's certainly a lot of awareness about the role of the United States in China, about the rising materialism, about the role of U.S. brands and U.S. companies in domestic Chinese society.
My guest is Zachary Karabell, K-A-R-A-B-E-L-L. His latest book, Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that Kentucky Fried Chicken, the first one, the store, opened in 1987. So we're talking about something that goes back a lot longer than I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, there was an economic opening, an experiment that China had in the mid-80s, led by Deng Xiaoping. But it was really confined to a few, quote-unquote, special economic zones that were entirely in the coastal provinces. And it was like a little experiment in, what if we adopted some more market reforms? How would that affect society? And because of Tiananmen, and because it was working so well, the decision was made to start extending that increasingly throughout the country. But for most of the 90s, it was still along the coast.
Now, Kentucky Fried Chicken is a company that's been in serious trouble in this country. Is it doing well in China?
See, that's the great contrast. China is now littered with mediocre American companies that became rock stars in China.
Why, did the Chinese like Kentucky Fried Chicken?
It's not that they particularly loved Kentucky Fried Chicken, but they loved initially and still have taken to this experience of hungering for a taste of modernity. And Kentucky Fried Chicken did a brilliant job of branding itself in China as a modern, hip experience of the capitalist world where anything was possible. And so it really didn't matter that people didn't like the food. They often said, you know, we're not really crazy about the food, but we love the experience and we hunger for it, literally and metaphorically.
The same thing has happened, I guess, with McDonald's and all of the other success stories, because to be honest, you can get a better hamburger.
Yeah, and again, you could go through a list now of hundreds of brands. Procter & Gamble's Oil of Olay became the first billion-dollar foreign cosmetic brand because it satisfied this desire of people to have some experience of a brand. I mean, brands are all about image and dreams and hopes, and a lot of American brands that were kind of tired here were new and exciting there, and General Motors, right, sells 1.6 million cars in China this year and is bankrupt in the United States.
So we have China with billions of people. We have India with billions of people, and they are obviously the future for American companies.
But India has yet to be very amenable to foreign companies selling in India. India really is a story of they provide some servicing and outsourcing, but they're really focused more in the Japan sense of we will control our own domestic economy. China has been much more welcoming of...
Is it because China watched what happened with Japan? Because Japan had this boom period, but then they had their major economic crisis, and perhaps some of that could have been ameliorated if they had been a little more globalized.
A little bit, although what I think China really was looking at was the experience of the Soviet Union and then post-Soviet Russia. So the Soviet Union adopts hypercharged political reform. The system collapses. You know, Gorbachev, we think, is a hero, but he definitely led to the end of the empire. And then the Russian state that followed decides, okay, we're going to accept the wisdom of the West and liberalize our economy and open up to trade. And then the Russian economy collapses in the 90s. And the Chinese leadership didn't want either. They didn't want to lose their control because of political reform, but they also didn't want to mismanage economic reform and get flooded by Western capital. So they adopt this hybrid model.
And I always wondered why the Russians didn't look to China and say, why aren't we doing something like that?
I think
that's what Putin is trying to do now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that by the time they did it, it was a little bit too late. But I think now a lot of people around the world, and this is a mixed bag example. It's true in the Middle East today of people going, huh, maybe we don't have to pursue the Washington consensus of liberalizing the political system and liberalizing the economic system. Maybe we can have state-driven economic reform that enriches society but leaves a lot of these other things to the future.
How did the dot-com boom of the 90s in the United States influence economic growth in China? Because China resisted opening up the internet, didn't it?
Yeah, and it still does. I mean, you have the irony today that a lot of the foreign businesses and American businesses that are particularly successful in China are the old economy U.S. companies, the Kentucky Fried Chickens, the Procter & Gambles, the Caterpillars, you know, which make these earth-moving machines in China, for sale in China, that are central to the industrialization of and urbanization of China right now. So you have these old economy companies, many of which were the losers or the also-rans in the 1990s, that had to seek new markets. Federal Express was a great example, which both integrated the communications technologies of the internet to become more efficient, but also said, look, we're still in the business of just moving stuff from point A to point B, and this entire Pacific Rim is underserved. So FedEx invested billions of dollars in the late 80s and 90s to be in China and is now reaping the rewards.
My guest is Zachary Karabell, K-A-R-A-B-E-L-L, president of River Twice Research, where he analyzes economic and political trends. He's also a senior advisor for business and social responsibility. And his latest book is called Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after this. I'm back with an interview from November with Zachary Karabell. He was here to discuss his book, Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. One of the things we talked about was President Clinton's controversial decision in 1994 to renew China's most favored nation trade status, despite its human rights record and in spite of many of the concerns people had about our economic relationship. I asked Zachary Carabel, in retrospect, was that the right decision?
I think in retrospect it was the right decision, although it remains a bitter pill for a lot of Americans to swallow, because what China then was beginning to confront the United States with, but what it really confronts the United States with today, is how does America, which has gotten so used to being the predominant power and so used to exert its will around things it wants or thinks is right, what do we do with a country that cannot be coerced in that way, even when it does things that we find morally objectionable, particularly when we don't have the luxury to detach from them as a sign of our disapproval.
And we have situations like China's relations with Sudan and other repressive third world states, which has allowed China to gain major economic inroads in places that probably even after those terrible governments are toppled, the Chinese will be there.
And in some sense, what China is doing today is not unlike a lot of what the United States did in the 1950s, which is seek alliances with countries, in our case in the 50s, with countries that opposed the Soviet Union. And we didn't care as much, other than whether they opposed communism, what the domestic warp and woof was. China is trying to arrange a series of agreements, particularly in Africa, particularly in Latin America, with countries that are resource rich.
Do they see themselves ultimately as rivals of the United States, or are they just simply trying to expand their business opportunities?
I think it depends on the moment and whom you ask. So China speaks of a peaceful rise, of live and let live, as being a very fundamental core of the way they engage the world, which means China doesn't want anyone to really criticize how they govern internally. The government doesn't. And so one of the ways they try to secure that is they don't criticize how any other government governs internally.
Well, we also are caught in some kind of a contradiction. On the one hand, we say we don't want to trade with these awful countries like Sudan. On the other hand, we say, well, we'll trade with China, which also has a repressive regime, because trade encourages positive political development.
Yeah, and U.S. policy, particularly around human rights, has always been mixed when it comes to this question of, do you engage as a way of encouraging change, or do you disengage as a way of coercing change? It's part of the debate, I think, now around Iran or North Korea as well. China, though, has reached the point where, unlike those examples, we can't disengage. We can't sanctions against China are not either going to happen, nor can we literally afford it. And that, I think that's a difficult pill to swallow. That doesn't necessarily mean the United States needs to be less active, less prosperous, less powerful, but it means that our power and prosperity need to be secured in a different way than they were secured for the prior 50 years of the 20th century.
China joined the World Trade Organization quietly in 2001, away from the eyes of both the American and Chinese publics. What were the public objections to the move in both countries?
Yeah, so in December of 2001, when China joins the World Trade Organization, and look, joining a World Trade Organization is not a bells and whistles moment. I mean, it's a sign of a document. It's not a, you know, honor guard and
yeah, but
pompous.
It does give you all sorts of privileges.
And it's very important. But at the time, the United States is focused on the aftermath of 9/11, on the invasion of Afghanistan. You know, that's where the attention of the Americas was and of the world. But as it turns out, that proved to be, I think, a more important occurrence than maybe any of those things that were occupying the attention at the time. And it remains one of the reasons that propelled China ever more tightly into an economic embrace with the United States.
Well, we have experienced the loss of an awful lot of jobs in the manufacturing sector and an influx of inexpensive and sometimes not very good consumer goods. In your opinion, was the trade-off worthwhile?
Well, first of all, the United States has been shedding manufacturing jobs since the 1970s. And this began with Taiwan and China, Taiwan and Japan as the low-cost competitors. It continued with Mexico. Remember, the whole uproar around NAFTA was that there'd be a giant sucking sound of jobs heading south of the border.
Russ Perot never even mentioned China.
That's right, because that wasn't in the cards yet. So China's just the next chapter of that story. It didn't create this trend. And it's certainly true that some jobs have literally gone to China, but it is equally true that a lot of those jobs had already gone to Mexico. Mexico has lost a lot more due to the rise of China, as has Japan, than the United States.
Well, it's also interesting that we didn't face a trade deficit with Mexico, but we face a big one with China. Is there anything beneficial in that trade deficit?
I think trade figures tell only part of the story. So, for instance, if a lot of goods enter the port of Long Beach in Los Angeles, they are treated as an import. They're negative on our GDP. And particularly if a company used to make the stuff here and now makes it there, we see it as somehow an erosion of the American economic base. What we don't see in the trade statistics is the more volume of activity in the port of Long Beach, the more people are employed offloading those ships, the more people that are employed on trucks and trains shipping those stuff, and the more goods may be affordable to Americans than had been ever before.
But hasn't all of that come at some price? We have unsafe products. Both here and the Chinese, by the way, have suffered as well. Lower wages in China are fueling this. Sweatshop working conditions, child labor in some cases.
I would not argue with any of that. And there is no question that this kind of fusion and this emerging economic intertwinement is not an unalloyed good, nor is it an unalloyed negative. And it comes with lots of issues. You know, the product safety one, I would say, is subtler than we think of it. And I actually looked through 20 years of records from the Consumer Product Safety Administration. And the rate of consumer product safety incidents coming from China is actually no greater than it was coming from just goods in general in the 1980s and 1990s.
Because people always cheat?
Companies always cheat. And the fact is, most of these product safety issues are not a result of Chinese lax culture. In fact, China has arrested and, frankly, executed a few of the people who are responsible for these product safety things, which we certainly wouldn't do. But it's the companies themselves. So, Mattel, very interesting what happened with Mattel and lead-tainted toys, initially blamed China. And then actually the Mattel executives realized that it had been their lax enforcement of product standards in their factories in China that was the result of these issues. And they kind of retracted and said, look, this is our responsibility. I think we have every right to expect safe products, but it should be, the emphasis should be on the companies that are producing them, just as it was on Firestone tires in the 1980s, just as it was on Perrier and benzene issues. It's the companies, not the country, that are responsible.
My guest is Zachary Carabel. His latest book, Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. China reacted to criticisms of its environmental record before the 2008 Olympics by drastically cleaning up the air around Beijing. But is China committed to cutting emissions over the long run?
It's interesting that I think the climate change issues, which are going to become more heated, pun intended, in the lead up to the Copenhagen summit in December, is one area where negotiations between China and the United States have been increasingly fruitful. And China, I think, has, at least the Beijing government, has turned a real corner in the past couple of years, realizing that the kind of industrial growth that they're on the path of is becoming so environmentally deleterious that it's creating health issues, it's creating actual impediments to future growth.
And they are the second largest polluter in the world. The United States is the largest polluter. It's hard for us to get too self-righteous about this.
And the Chinese, for instance, are saying, look, when you calculate our emissions, you should take responsibility for American-owned factories. So Nike operating a factory in China, that should be an American emission or a Nike emission, not a Chinese emission. So there's certainly a lot of debates about how you score these things. I think the bottom line, though, is that Beijing is now committed with a sense of urgency to actually spend money on alternate forms of energy, because the fact is, for the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to depend on coal, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Well, since they are building the new factories, they can build them better than adjusting old factories.
And Beijing, again, is committed. The problem is they don't have quite the control over provincial growth that we think they do. But it is clearly the case that when the Chinese government and when Beijing decides to act with urgency, their ability to put money into those projects with alacrity is clearly greater than our ability, the U.S.'s ability, to act with urgency.
That's because they're still a dictatorship, and if somebody at the top says, I want this, more often than not, he'll get it.
And that's, I think, something we simply have to deal with, which is in a global competitive environment where that's who we're competing with, they have a competitive advantage.
A caller named Richard owns a few restaurants in New York. He's thinking about opening up some locations in China, and he's wondering about the climate for small businesses in China, not Kentucky Fried Chicken, not Procter & Gamble, not General Motors.
I think, in fact, China as a source of entrepreneurial advantage has been unequivocal. I mean, you know, a lot of this is anecdotal, right? But so a wedding designer that I sat next to on a long flight to China had opened a small boutique in Toledo or some part of Ohio. And because he was able to shift his production to China and someone was able to take care of the logistics, he was able to produce a lot more of these dresses and suddenly open up 10 different boutiques because his cost structure had shifted. And you could tell 1,000 stories like this. And in fact, it's much easier to go and actually get stuff made in China than it would be to do so in any part of the world.
One of the problems in Russia was you never knew who you had to deal with and who you had to pay a bribe to. That's not the case in China.
No, it's not. I think it's a little hard if you're going to build a factory in China and there is a certain amount of localized corruption that you have to navigate. But it's nothing. I mean, Russia today is absurd. And I mean, IKEA recently suspended operations in Russia because the kind of institutionalized payoffs meant that not only did you have to pay people off, you didn't even know whether once you paid them off, you were going to get what you were going to get. China's actually fairly committed to making it easy for foreign businesses to do business in China because they feel it's a constructive part of their own domestic model.
As long as you don't try to change other things, start running for office.
That's right. But look, I mean, 3% of New Yorkers voted in the runoff for the district attorney. It's not clear how much people actively need to participate in the political process in the United States. So when we wonder about why aren't people more discontent, you know, most people are really focused in China on their daily lives. And part of their daily lives is getting rich. That may be objectionable and morally questionable, but it is, in fact, a lot of the societal glue today.
Well, there's also a cynical side. Some years back, somebody told me that after the Cultural Revolution, which he had made a major commitment to and then felt totally disillusioned by, he decided that he would never really take politics seriously, and all he was interested in was getting ahead and making as much money as he could.
And I think that is truly a motive force in a lot of Chinese society today. And there are people who are questioning the moral character of China in China. That's like a big internal debate. Who are we? What are our values? What does this society mean except for making money and enriching? And, you know, it may just be that this is the cultural moment in China where that's the focus, just as it might have been in the United States in 1890.
A new survey by the state-sanctioned China Federation of Logistics and Purchasing just came out with the statistics that say China's economy grew by 8.9% in the third quarter. That's the highest rate for any major economy. Now, I don't know whether that information is accurate, but to some degree, isn't that also because China is starting at a lower point? So, you know, if you start at $100 and make $300, that's that's triple. Whereas if you're starting at $1,000 and make it $1,500, it's one third.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question we shouldn't treat China's economic growth statistics as exactly the same as the U.S. and say, well, therefore China's growing much more quickly. That being said, China is now a $4 or $5 trillion economy, at least adjusted. And if it's growing at 8 or 9% a year, and frankly, I think if you really look at China that matters, i.e. the 200-300 million middle class and the China that's integrated and industrializing, that part of China is actually growing much more quickly because there's still 700 million people on rice farms. So the fact of China's growth is beginning to shape global commodity prices. It's shaping global supply chains. It does, in fact, have a profound effect on the U.S. and the global system.
And you're right that we have to begin to understand nation states is just one type of economic player in the global market. There are companies with annual incomes larger than some countries' GDPs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at IBM alone, its profits for this year will exceed the GDP of Iraq. And it's not to say that, therefore, IBM is more important than Iraq, but it is to say that there's...
Well, but we're not invading it.
And we're not. And I mean, Armonk remains a relatively safe place. Mm. But it is true that these companies are shaping a global system in a different way that nation states are.
At the same time, the story of this recession says that lack of financial regulation by our national government led to a credit crisis that had a worldwide impact.
Yeah. I mean, we're obviously engaged in a debate about what the source of this was. It's clearly true that the U.S. economy hasn't been producing quite the level of growth that a lot of Americans desire, expect, or need. And so we've looked for other ways to augment that. One of the ways we've looked to augment it is by doing business in China. Not all of this has a good consequence for the United States. But it's certainly true that The fact that we've invested so much in China and they have in turn loaned so much to America has created a kind of circularity of capital that, in the absence of which, we would have had a much harder time digging ourselves out of the past year of crisis.
Just one more thing before we go. Those 700 million people on rice farms in China, are they part of Chimerica too?
No. And one of the reasons I think to continue to look to this as an emerging story is what's been going on the past year is that the Chinese government has been orchestrating the industrialization and urbanization of the interior of the country, whereas most of what's happened over the past 20 years has been in the coast, so that those hundreds of millions of rural poor people can move into cities, which is a whole next wave of economic activity within China that we haven't even begun to see yet.
And what happens when all of those farmers move into the cities? Who's going to be producing the food for the people in the cities?
Well, I mean, the food issue is less acute because technology has allowed us to produce more food than ever before. I think the real issues are if more and more Chinese participate in this middle-class modern economy, then the amount of natural resources that the world currently produces for things like cars and buildings is clearly inadequate to the amount of demand that China, and let alone a country like India, is going to have, which means that I think the kind of price spikes we saw last year in 2008 of oil, of copper, of iron ore, of steel, are going to be mild by comparison. And I'm concerned that we're not prepared for those kind of price shocks, for those kind of commodities, which the growth of China, unfortunately, in the short term, presages.
Zachary Karabell, Karabell, his book, Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.